Okay, I'm continuing my dialogue with Derek DeKirchhoff, and this is May 20th, 2016. We haven't had a chance to record in a while. Derek's been very busy, but we have a moment here. So Derek had sent me this article by Benjamin Barber, written almost 25 years ago, that Derek researched for his magazine work today, and it's called Jihad versus McWorld, written by Benjamin Barber, and the subtitle is The Two Axial Principles of Our Age, Tribalism and Globalism, Clash at Every Point Except One. They may both be threatening to democracy. Now, Derek's done a lot of talking with people about this article, has re-interviewed Benjamin Barber and other people. So he doesn't necessarily want to go into much detail about it, but I wanted to tell him what I thought of it since I took time to read it. The idea of democracy, Derek, has so changed since 92 when he wrote this article that that's the weakness. I don't think we know what democracy is unless we go back on McLuhan and William Merrill and Thompson's idea that it's just pure participation. There's no longer an involvement of a citizen with a point of view representing the accumulated knowledge of that particular person. It's up against the group mind, but the group mind has been fragmented by the Web 2.0 so that we're what I would call a very tactile situation between super individuation and super merger on a global level beyond bureaucratic democracy. And so I kept thinking about how inadequate his description was for today. It's not bad for back then, but we've been through many I would say shrinkages of the globe, many variations of tribalism, and we've survived. It's and there is the illusion of democracy in the way the West conducts it, but that's not what we should be looking at. So,
no, I agree with the illusion idea.
Yes.
I mean, it's true. The reason we entertain the illusion is because we don't have an alternative, for one. And for the second, we'd like to keep the things the way they are, having seen the failure of so many revolutions. So people are afraid. They're afraid. They're even trusting an untrustworthy money system and financial system in order not to rock a boat that they're afraid to sink with. So I think we're in a very critical time, and that's why I was interested in about the issue of jihad versus Macworld. And one of the things to say about this is that jihad is only possible because tribes have gone global. If they weren't global, locally, the guys wouldn't be able to do anything, but they're spread all over the world, and that's what it is. The tribe is now global, and all of us are globalized tribally.
Yeah, okay. So the two words merge, tribalism and globalism, but there's two kinds. There's the TV body, the TV landscape, which has global tribalism, but with the chip body and the fragmentation and super individuation, which would be what was called the trend towards globalism 25 years ago, that has fragmented back not to a tribalism, but to a super autonomy, at least as long as you have the chip body. So it's they flipped on each other.
Yes, there's that. There's at least that also. I mean, that's just for me as illusory as democracy.
Yes.
To be perfectly frank. The difference, though, about global tribalism, and not just putting them together, but seeing how they merge, is that there is no need for proximity for community of purpose, and that's what jihad is all about. Having distributed people all over the planet, they can count on a kind of a reversal of the traditional military strategy, which was that you put a lot of guns out there and kill a lot of people, and then you win or lose the war. Now you put a lot of propaganda out there, you kill a few people, enough to actually terrify, using the same propaganda, everybody in the world, and you could not necessarily win the war, but certainly keep it going for a while.
Yeah.
And you would spend a lot less money, and all your whole army would consist, it's the mouse that roared, your army is 30,000, you know, badly trained hoodlums, and then you're getting everybody on their knees, the whole European scene who should never have gotten into Syria, but they've done it and they've done it, that's it.
Right.
The point is, we're in a mess because of a tribal, the propaganda of a tribal warfare conducted with minimal expenses.
Right. And then you see recent terrorism done by teenagers or just alienated 22-year-olds.
Exactly. No, it's absolutely amazing. It
yeah.
really is. So what we're doing, what we're seeing now is indeed an entirely different kind of way of doing war, of conquering places. Certainly democracy is being flouted everywhere, including in our own backyard. Democracy, it would be lovely to be able to come up, you and I, with a really useful and enlightening definition of democracy that anybody could understand. And I'm afraid I'm still working on it.
Okay, let's attempt that. But first I want to ask you, what did Barber say when you interviewed him? Or is that in your article? That's the exclusive.
No, it was not so much an interview. It was a matter. He sent us a kind of an update, which was an introduction. He published a book called Jihad versus Macworld 2 years yeah. after the article came out. And then he is now publishing a reviewed edition where he has made, of course, several changes, but I didn't see the whole reviewed edition. He only sent me the introduction, which I have not gotten as much from it as I did from the initial paper, because there the insights were very strong. I was particularly interested in his study of the combination of the market imperative, you know, all the imperative. He talks about the resource imperative, yes. the information technology imperative, and then the ecological imperative. All these things are true, and they're still true today. And applying them together in convergence to see what they are pushing us to, well, now I would say the security imperative, I would add that, because it's exactly what's happening anyway through the normal business world, you know, spying on every one of us to sell us more stuff. Well, there's a small step from that to be completely transparent,
yeah.
hence incapable of hiding any Kalashnikov in any way.
Right.
This is where security is going. So there is a security imperative, and we're bound to go through it and be processed by it. I don't see any way out.
Okay,
I don't see any way out. And
so does he say that he was limited at any points, or he thinks he was right? Has he changed his view at all?
No, he didn't. I don't think he even questioned his I don't remember. I can go and check it, because the thing he sent me was here. I have to find it, though. That's the question.
Okay, it's all right. So let's then tackle what's it mean, the term democracy. People are so communistically involved with each other on many levels through Web 2.0 and Web 1.0. The exchange of information and people thinking, or at least producing information, just in the commentaries of any articles that go out, any news stories, it is so huge. The super angel of people communicating, expressing, it is definitely Baudrillard's ecstasy of communication. Now, does that satisfy people just to communicate? Is that what democracy didn't and have, you know, 200 years ago, and hope that, okay, you get educated population, they've got opinions, they read newspaper articles, they read Ben Franklin, and then they have an opinion, they vote on it. That seems like a really ridiculous old form of democracy. So what is our new democracy, where everybody is really more interested in being a critic or commentating than actually doing anything in the bureaucracy of solutions in Congress or something? You get what I'm saying there?
I do. It's just that democracy was the power. It was, first of all, the meaning was the power of the people, right?
Yeah.
Democracy means power, and demos means the people. It was invented by the Greek as a product of the alphabet, as a product of literacy.
Right.
No doubt about that. The connection is direct. It is no surprise that democracy is facing a tremendous amount of challenges today, because the basis, the ground of human experience today, and particularly in politics, is no more the bureaucracy of the letter and the printed paper. It is now the instant flash of your records anywhere they're needed. So it's an entirely different kind of medium that supports the political or the social or socio-political kind of feeling that people share. What is the feeling that people share about being free in an open space today? It's still there. It's full of doubts. Great. It's
yeah.
full of doubts, because indeed it's threatened, and it's threatened terminally. I don't think we'll go back to the past. But I'm sure that something of the past we must and will keep, unless we all blow up. because we still share space. We still share space in a specific way. we still need services. Those services still need to be funded in some fashion by the people who use them. There are all kinds of truly just realistic needs that actually have to be filled. Whether we want this to be done by representation, as we did in the past, where we trust somebody, well, we already know we can't trust anybody. That's over. I mean, is there anything we know since WikiLeaks all the way, all the whistleblowers have been pretty cool at saying it, we can't trust anybody, right? So in that case, then you have to find a system where either everybody's on the guard, everybody is under surveillance, as manners do in certain levels of society, in certain levels of manner. This is not done. Well, we'll get to the point where this is not done, like not paying your taxes.
Right.
So I see ethics coming before, in fact, politics.
Okay, so you have, McLuhan talked about the program planet, you know, back in the 1560s, and that sounded like fascism to the literate critics like Lewis Lapham and those people. They didn't like, we're a program, but they didn't understand, people didn't understand, have the vision of the complexity of all the environments interacting and doing what you just said in people's lives. So the programming of our environment, which some people think is fascism or communism, has to be redefined and then accepted. So that brings in Wyndham Lewis's great title, The Art of Being Ruled. That seems to be perception one, what you have to sort of give into. You know what I mean?
Yes.
So
it's we have to be able, unless we continue to be terrified as we are now, we have to be able to enjoy the state, not just the state and the power, but the state of things, the state, things as they are. And things as they are have a tendency of changing fast enough that people get really mad. And they go to Arab Springs, and then they go to revolution, and then they go to tyranny. And the point is, our real problem is that the walls of democracy are very permeable to tyranny. And tyranny is at the door. It's at the door in many ways, not simply because we have, you know, the war of civilization and all that stuff that people can discuss yes or no. No, we also have a system within ourselves. The enemy, is us. We have within our own system a means of being entirely possessed.
Okay, but let me qualify that. I don't think we can define what tyranny is anymore. There's so much freedom, at least in the West, in people's lives, and the way they don't have any responsibility to any communities. They can do whatever they want. They can make up ad hoc nano communities and do this and that for a while. All the old moralities are thrown out. So there's incredible...
That's why I'm just saying ethics will precede politics. We will start by changing from within, because there's no other way we can expect anybody
to tell us
what to do.
What are we supposed to change? What are we supposed to change, though? I don't see...
That's the point. That's the question. That is the question. And that's a very good question, which we want to follow. But I'd like to come back to the issue that tyranny is no, there's no place for tyranny. There's plenty of place for tyranny. There's plenty of place for not following any kind of laws, being above the law, we really have it at the door. We have people being murdered randomly in the streets of big cities.
That's the issue, is that anybody can kill anybody, and there can be secret death squads, not just from the government. There can be subcultures of death squads.
That's right. And that's what I'm saying. That's the global tribe.
Right. So how... So then you would have to have incredible surveillance, and that's not going to be that successful, but you would accept incredible surveillance.
Don't be so sure. It's going to be better and better. A lot of big data are telling just about anything you know. And basically, the surveillance team has money and talent, and they will always be more intelligent than the guys who are attacking them. They will be, but it's going to be a long while. We don't want that, and it's a very uncomfortable feeling to be in this kind of extra stress over that of daily life. People don't need that. So they will try to, they'll actually, first of all, they will accept being totally surveilled. They will. They won't mind about that. The question is, how much symmetry can we expect in a continued democracy changed but still called democracy process going on? That's the question.
Right,
how much do we need to know about the guys who know about us? How much is legal to be known and not to be known? Or how much is legal to use and not to use, whether it's known or not? There are all kinds of legal, and I would say, which become evidently a politics. But that's the kind of thing we have to look into. Some kind of structure of law, which is the only way that works, and that's democracy, must protect the people and the governments from each other. And
right,
we
but
don't
think,
have...
But there's rogue elements, and they're not necessarily gangsters. They are Pentagon people, what people like to say, the CIA. There are people there who want to keep the armaments industry going, and they will fund terrorism to seem like there's an enemy. So there's that level.
I actually don't think
you can monitor any. I think we have to get used
to anarchy. No, Bob, you can't. All you can do is look back at the Renaissance and see how long it takes for those jerks to get their act together. 200 years. No, really. So, and so now we're looking at probably less time, hopefully less time, to get our act together. Well, we don't know what that act is.
That's right. Well, we don't know anything anymore. I call this a post-information.
No, we don't.
I should call it a para-information. We're around, beside it, near it.
We're now doing the very best intellectual sport in a French cafe. We're rebuilding the world. So it's really not a fun.
Okay.
But,
so with it, with our super sophisticated understanding of the futility of most attempts to preserve something, what would we call a program towards something called democracy or some better situation? You know, Barry Nevitt wrote a book called The Communication Ecology, and he meant that the ecology already was there. The balance is in the canceling out of all the different environments. McLuhan didn't like the word cancellation, but the fact that everything is balancing, there's always roadkill, but in general, it's incredible how many few plane accidents there are, how many this kind of accident or that kind, or even nuclear. You can say that the protection of people on those hardware matters is pretty extraordinary.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
No, it is. I mean, and in fact, the whole world's like a sieve. You know, you can go anywhere with anything today and get away with it. I've just crossed the ex-frontier between Italy and France at least 8 times in the last 2 weeks, and I can tell you, you're not stopped anywhere. I could be a migrant. I could be an army of migrants if I wanted to.
Right.
Anyway, but it's maybe. What you're saying sort of makes me feel that there is a self-organization principle of balancing that is at work. But what the lesson here from McLuhan, and I think I'm not that good to apply it, but from McLuhan is, what are the properties, what are the line of force of the ground of such experience of which we're all the figures? So if electricity is the ground, which I think it is, he made it clear. Now, what are the aspects of electricity that we can see reflected by the situation today and not so much, and yearnings, leanings towards a solution?
The problem is today is people feel superior to the electric situation. That's what the super angelization of Web 2.0, maybe it's even Web 3.0 now, people do not feel subject to the broadcasting imposition that we had through most of the 20th century. So people now feel bigger than Wolf Blitzer or whoever the major networks are, and this is reflected in the election. Why is the issue of Trump and his image, or Sanders and his image, is what everybody's yelling about from different sides? Now, here's an update. I have a friend who has a son who's about 25 years old, works in some corporation. He's for Trump. So he wore a T-shirt, Make America Great. Well, other people in his job, the Sanders people, said, you're supporting a fascist, blah, blah, blah. They intimidate him, so he took the shirt off. He's going to vote for Trump, and his friends are going to vote for Trump aren't going to tell anybody. This is a new effect where people in the workplace are dividing and becoming aggressive against each other. That's a new dimension.
It is. That's definitely it. But then again, at the beginning of some very serious, I don't want to say a word, but mirrored if you want, is signaled by these kinds of
symptoms
of occurrences. Trump is a phenomenon. Trump is a phenomenon of pure emotion. It's
yeah.
not. There's no reason behind Trump. There's no knowledge behind Trump. People
right.
who vote for Trump don't have a clue.
Right. So
they don't know who he
no
is.
Longer,
they don't care.
Right. We no longer require to be an informed public. The old literate definition of having a
That's
functioning
right.
democracy. So there's a whole other emotional. Instant ESP thing going on, like between different kinds of insects in the hive. You know, you have one kind of insects.
Yeah.
Then you got these kids who live in a total software communist environment with their constant texting. But, they don't understand that Bernie Sanders would have been shot 30, 40 years ago. You can't talk like that when you can't be a communist and run for president. But the kids are totally different from any previous generation, and they're going by
yeah.
the emotion of feeling of sharedness, whereas Trump sort of represents individuation, right? The idea of a
mm-hmm.
guy becoming a billionaire and separating himself from the hive. But the
yeah,
hive...
But they're both of them are icons, and it's good that you put Sanders as opposed to Clinton against
yeah.
Trump here, because Clinton is not interesting. But both of them are icons of the bipartisan approach of the American spirit.
Yeah.
Neither is satisfying to his own party. Like, the communist dimension of Sanders doesn't really please the Democratic Party,
no.
and not certainly the Republican kind of rah-rah doesn't please the Republican establishment. So we're experiencing two extreme of long-term existing trends, hyper-individualism, which is, I think, Trump represents very well, and then a very kind of, well, I couldn't call it tribal socialism. It's not quite that, although it might turn out to be that.
Well, I saw a cartoon.
I see that Sanders still represents the old democracy illusion.
Right, right. Now, in a cartoon it said, Bernie was democratic socialism, Trump was fascist, and Hillary was oligarchy. She's above it. She's
yes.
friends with the Queen and the Rothschilds or whatever.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah,
people
yeah.
see her
yeah.
as part of the secret Big Brother world government. And do you
no,
see?
She's House of Cards, man.
Yes, that's right. Oh yeah,
she's
I like that
House
joke.
Of Cards. She's,
yeah, yeah,
she's
yeah.
Robin Wright.
Yeah, that's right. Exactly. And the people know it now. I think that TV
yeah.
show. Julia Dreyfus, I think her name is, does Veep is a tremendous show. There's been so many exposures of the dynamics of the AIDS and everything around the politicians that I think that people have been educated over the last 5 years by these shows.
They have. Why
yeah.
do they trust any one of these bastards?
Yeah.
You're praying.
Now, I say the hidden ground here, though, is that they have to have a series showing the battle for getting the Oscars and showing the directors or their managers killing each other to get an Oscar. That is the hidden
yeah.
ground. The show business part, it's easy to blame the politicians, but they're not dealing with the technocrats who run the software entertainment every day, which is the real democracy or
exactly.
real government. You know what I mean?
Well, you know, this I've just had to write a paper for the RePublica here, one of the main, I'd say, central-left newspapers of Italy,
yes.
About the whistleblowers. So they asked me, you know, what I think about the role of the whistleblower and
yeah.
And it was also about democracy. Are they really the pillars of democracy? And first of all, you have to know what their motivations are. But even so, their function, whether motivation is to get celebrity or it is to get money or simply to do one's, you know, social and political duty, that is one aspect that's interesting, but it doesn't bear on the function of whistleblowing itself, which is actually much, much more prevalent than simply the figures of, all the way from Assange to whoever is the guy for Panama Papers.
Right.
Right?
Yeah.
But their function is, and the question was put to me, do you believe that they are a pillar of democracy? and I think it was a very good question. Yes, certainly they are a pillar of whatever would continue democracy in the new setting, in the new condition. They are not, let's say, they're more like the reconciliation of democracy with whatever system is going to replace it. And it's because we need that. It's a fantastic function. For some things go on forever until people are told in full, you know, with numbers and everything, what
yeah.
is actually happening. Now, here's the question, and this is an aside, but it's an interesting one. There is a man called Birkenfeld who was actually very much responsible for the Swiss leaks, and he's a banker who was working for the USB Bank, and he actually was the one who released umpteen numbers of Americans who were using that particular bank for tax evasion.
Yeah.
Well, created one of the big scandals, because there were Italians, French, and Germans, and all kinds of people, obviously, but that's what was the first thing. Then he was asked, everybody thought that he had something to do with, you know, Panama Papers, because nobody knows who did Panama Papers. For the first time, we don't have the name of the big leak, so to speak.
Right.
So the question is, who did it? And then some people say it's a guy called himself John Doe. And some people say, some people say it's so-and-so, some people say it's so-and-so, but he says, no, I don't think so. I don't think this is an individual. And here's the question. He says it's the CIA. Why? Because there's no American or hardly any American that actually revealed in 1.5 million papers
right.
that have been released by Panama Papers. Okay. So for him, that means that actually is a ploy. It's governed by leakage, and we know that that has been done before. It's a ploy to actually get back to Russia, against Russia, because
right.
Putin has been found with his trousers down. And all kinds of people that are not terribly friendly to Uncle Sam actually have been, you know, shown with their hands down. And so that's a very good point. Why? Because if an individual, for whatever purpose, creates the function of revealing something that he or she feels unjust or irregular or dangerous or whatever, that's one thing. That's the relation between the individual and the state. If, on the other hand, the state is using that ploy that people begin to really trust, because, yes, when you reveal a feature, it actually is trustworthy, and it is followed by consequences, so people begin to say, you know, whistleblowing is part of our culture. We can count on it to keep it clean. And we are actually, you know, perfectly, so we'll make them heroes. But if the government begins to use the same system, leakage in that sense, that looks like whistleblowing,
yeah.
then we're screwed. Once again, that's a form of totally anti-democratic way of behaving. It's scary.
And that cancels information, become a para post-information society. Now, remember McLuhan
exactly.
said platforms and viewpoints won't work in politics anymore. He said that back in the 60s. Well, Trump is showing
yeah.
you don't even have to finish your sentence, what you're calling relying on a feeling, to actually communicate.
Yeah.
So if texting is what I call cloning of ESP, we have a very highest decibels of human communication going on in the speed and rapidity of the texting life people have. And then a guy comes in who mimes the texting because he jumps from topic to topic, hardly completing anything. That's how people text.
Yeah.
They're dealing with it. So you have
the
White House always has the image of what's going on, very close to what's going on. Clinton was a perfect image for the beginning of the information society, he and Gore in the 90s. Then you had to have a guy who ignored information. That's George Bush Jr. And then you had to have a totally revolutionary guy who's not even an American, who knows what he is, an alien, comes in, and that sort of fulfills the anti-white idea, you know, bringing in an image that is totally disconnected from all the white guys before. So that image failed. Now you have an image of a guy who's got ESP and doesn't even have to finish his sentences. He's hoiking
yeah,
up
but,
ESP.
Okay. Yeah, but I would still be aware of the fact that Trump is definitely a representative of potential tyranny. Definitely.
Yes.
So what I'm saying,
tyranny is not
disappeared at all.
No, there's people still worried about, I don't know, whatever they worry about there out in the boondocks. They're worried about a lack of a Christian education or something in their schools. There's so many concerns and different gradations of tyranny that I bet you we can't agree on what is tyrannical, even like we can't agree on what democracy is. We could tease apart and find out different kinds of tyranny, but the tyranny of Big Brother, McLuhan wrote that in Gutenberg Galaxy, it went inside. The kind of CIA murdering political problems, political people, has been going on for 50 years. It may have probably never stopped since World War II. But there's other kinds of tyrannies that people believe in now. Yet, like wearing a T-shirt that supports someone you don't like, and you have the right to say that T-shirt represents fascism. That's a new kind of mentality in the people. They have a different kind of ethics, or they have a different valuation of things. That's confusing a lot of issues about what is a value.
Mm-hmm.
What's valuable?
No, well, Yeah, and those values are going to be very different for somebody who was educated on literacy the way I was.
Yeah.
And somebody who was just born on the 01 business, they'll have pretty different values.
Well, they don't even have the same images as you have. Your image reservoir of movies and magazines and books and all the old hot media, or let's say analog media, these people don't have any of those images. Like, bringing in Ion says that the millennials, for the first time, have no contact with any cultural background all the previous societies had. They're totally disconnected, and they're in a new zone of making. I don't even know what you call it, how they live. But they do not have anything connected to the past, to their parents, or anything. That's totally new, that kind of radical split between the generations. Mm-hmm.
No, it's true that it's quite amazing, and so and they don't have a past.
That's right, they don't have a past.
No,
they
do.
In a big now.
It's in their directory of Facebook. And, you know,
yeah, it's in the cloud. It's in the cloud. You know,
the cloud. It really is.
Can you imagine that?
Okay,
you're having an archive in the cloud, and even using those words.
Kind of democratic principle at work can work with these people?
I think they just want to have more comfort. They say they go for Bernie saying, yeah, free education, free universities, free this, free that. They don't understand about at least the old kind of economics that had to be a give and take. And McLuhan said back in the 70s that the give and take of old-fashioned economics is going to suffer an identity because the blur of the information society makes people gradually lose awareness of the give and take, and they just require access and mobility to anything. They want access to total mobility. He said to you in that recording in 1980, you had that great recording. He says people want total mobility.
Yeah, they do.
And then they got psychic mobility with the Internet. So you got to bring in my – first of all, I love Wyndham Lewis. Take his 1929 quote. I'm part fascist, part communist. I have a bit of monarchism in my Marxism, and I'm an anarchist with a healthy passion for order. That is the perfect – definition of the quadriphenic citizen today. That means you're schizophrenic.
You're right. That's good. I like that. That's very, very true. So what do you do with that mix?
Okay.
Put some oil and vinegar?
No. You take those four factors, and then you break it into four bodies. We have a chemical body needs your physical body. It's a chemical body because science rules the content of what is the physical body. Then you have this spiritual part of cultures and people. They look for something more spiritually, or they believe there's something more. So I call it the astral body. Then you have the TV body, which is a more passive, sitting back on the couch and taking in entertainment that you don't have to react to. You just enjoy it or not. So that's the TV body. Then you have the chip body, which is very hyperactive, constantly interacting, you're constantly monitoring it. It's monitoring you. That's the fourth body. Now you take these four bodies and their historical structures they brought in, and you could even attach a certain presidential image to each one of them. That is what everybody today quadriphenically is juggling. And so what are the environments each one of those bodies involves? So that management, you know what, we have a recording of McLuhan in the 70s saying, if you were president and you had the whole world relying on your opinion on things, what would you do, he says. Nobody says anything. He says, you'd do nothing. So the doing nothing was what Nixon did, I guess, and Carter and Reagan. But then the president started doing something else. You know, first Bush, Clinton, basically Clinton, I guess, was just having a good time. He just had a party. And the later Bush was doing, I don't know, he was doing nothing, but he was trying to make stupid impositions of democracy on countries around the world militarily.
Mm-hmm.
And that failed.
Mm-hmm. Well, there was a lot of petrol taking behind that one.
Yes. Now, interesting about Obama's image, if you go to the people who like Obama, they list off all his accomplishments. They say this guy's accomplished more than any president in 60 years, and they'll lay out the statistics. But then you have this other part of the population that hates Obama, and they think he's a big imposition on them. He brought in communism to them. They don't like the Medicaid and all that stuff. So the people don't know what image they require now. We've exhausted them all, so they're going on some kind of manipian guy who is pissed off at everything, and the people like that. They like – a lot of people like that image. And then there's the other kind of personality that's frightened by that, and they're saying, I'm going to leave the country, you know. The range of irrationality in the old terms – of you call emotion and feeling is so extreme that I think it'd be wise not to engage in voting. I mean, I don't see
no,
what you're voting for.
No, I agree. I absolutely agree with you. The only thing is that the times and the people are so troubled that they actually could vote Trump as president. I mean, it's not something that we are, you know, fine, he'll never get anywhere. No, he is out. He is getting somewhere. If he can cheat out the Republican Party to unite behind him, which he could. It's not conceivable.
Yeah.
People are distrusting Hillary Clinton, as they should, because not because she's a bad woman, I think she's a pretty good one, but because she represents and acts in a system that people distrust very much now.
Right, right. Her baby boomer, you know, icons of value don't apply anymore. I mean, she's the perfect.
They don't. This is why they might not vote for her. It's not because I don't think she's worse than the other. I mean, I don't think she'll do much worse than Obama.
Democrat. Are you aware in Europe of these pictures? They show Bernie Sanders with huge crowds and no coverage in the mainstream media about that.
That's the old management of politics.
Right. And they show Hillary with a gymnasium with 200 people, and they'll show her. And now the people hear about this censorship right away, and they can go around it. So the old form of management really is playing with fire. Their techniques, their values don't work anymore. It doesn't work.
They don't.
What Hillary represents. She represents the obsolete values.
So you put that together with cunning and forcefulness of Trump, and you're in danger.
Yeah. And I don't know if Trump, I don't think the president has power. I don't know what the power is.
Oh, wait a minute. It doesn't have power unless he rocks every bloody boat when he arrives, which is what he would do.
He would do what? I didn't get what he would do.
Rock every kind of alliances that normally maintain control.
He'd be part fascist, part communist, part anarchist, part monarchist, and part passion for order. He's going to do it all, and yet it'll be nothing, because how can people be controlled today other than they require rent and money? And people are doing so many different things. Do you ever look at the porn sites? Put in free porn. Millions of people are doing porn, and I don't know if it's because it's the only way they get money, but do they have that in Europe? Do you see that over there?
Oh, The aggressiveness of the European porn industry is a lot. It's more like the prostitution industry, but it's very aggressive. It does things that you could not possibly allow in the United States or Canada.
Oh, is that right? Okay, because
Yes.
It looks pretty.
Absolutely. You get regularly on the junk. It goes to the junk. It doesn't get into your mail, but regularly on the junk because they suss you out. You're a 70-year-old man. You might want to have a little girl on the round. They don't just show you the girl. They show you the boobs, the tits, the cunt, the world, everything. Sorry to be so blunt, but that's exactly what they do. But I want to tell you something about advertising, another aside. But the advertising today is becoming not just in the sex trade, enormously aggressive. You are now in situations where you cannot see something which legitimately you are allowed to just look at without having to go through some kind of video. Now, I understand going to a video if I get a free service in an airport because I want to get online. That's different. But I'm getting no service except the only, and that service is nothing to do with the people who are invading you. They're just invading you. That's it. Whatever it is, I think Google has managed to prevent it, but if it's anything else, you have to look at all the offers that you absolutely don't care about.
Yeah.
And it's very insistent. And it's visual, it's sidebars, it covers up your article. You're reading an article. Bingo, you got these jerks on your case.
Right.
Oh, this is horrible. But I'm saying that's another aspect of both manners, issues of general manners, how much can we take of this?
Right.
And of legislation that is not in place and that nobody wants to put in place because too many interests are still in place. And so the point is, that's why Sanders is talking to people. And that's what he's getting from. He's getting somehow a hearing from the point of view of where we are being screwed.
Yeah.
The other one is playing an entirely different level of politics. And it has nothing to do with the satisfaction of the people. That's why he's much worse. He's entirely a threat to democracy if we go back to the topic that we're, you know, started.
But I don't know what democracy, he's very democratic on the feeling level. He makes people feel that he feels them. They feel him. They feel the anger.
Yeah, listen, man, he's still a representative democracy, right? And that's what's wrong with the system.
But
think about the social movements that have happened since the Arab Spring. Most of them, if not all, were actually leaderless. Nobody's there to say what to do. People got together, decided they shared something and shared a purpose, and then worked at that purpose, as they are still doing in Paris today, which is called Nuit Debout, standing at night. People go, but thousands of people go to the square of the Republic, where else? I mean, Place de la République in Paris. They stand all night, and each one is entitled to 3 minutes and no more, after which he's just shot dead, to speak his mind. And so that gives a lot of people the chance to speak. People listen, they're interested, they chat among themselves there, and they think about what are the politics of Hollande and of this and of that, and whether Brexit, and they have opinions.
Okay,
they
that's the chemical body. That's chemical
body. It's a chemical body, right.
Yeah. Meanwhile, everybody's texting and commenting on the digital chip body that those people aren't paying attention to, at least while they're meeting in person. So we rotate between the different bodies. Now, you just gave me an idea. Yeah. Trump is a leaderless leader. He's not. He's not going to lead.
What are you talking about?
Right. He's a guy. He represents I'm one of you guys. I'm pissed off, and I don't know where we're going to lead, but we're going to change the situation. So you're saying that these revolutions in the Near East were leaderless. Well, Trump represents a kind of leaderlessness because he's not following any normal thinking that a leader would provide. He's just emoting.
Yeah.
I mean, I've seen a little bit of video. He comes to a rally. The first thing he says is, wow. He does not talk about emotion of multitude. He goes, wow. That wears everybody, right? He says, I love you people. And then he starts to imitate Hillary or something, and it's a crummy imitation, but it's good enough. Everybody's laughing. And then he moves to another topic, and then he yells at someone in the audience. It's actually, I died laughing when I was watching this stuff.
Well, he is. He's a comic. Right? Comics
yes.
have become. You know what? The king's jester is taking the place of the king.
Ah, well, look, I don't know if you remember this. What did McLuhan say about Trudeau? He was the first emperor come clown.
That's right. Well, we've got now another one. We've got a few, in fact. Certainly, Hollande is one.
But wait a minute.
Stoney was another.
I've been thinking about this. So
Trudeau
was an emperor come clown. And McLuhan wrote in 1968, he says, the United States was a country on the hot seat. It could not have a frivolous president or somebody being emperor and clown. So he says the states could never have it, but Canada could. Well, the states have become so eroded in so many ways, its own self-image, that they finally arrived at an extreme version of Trudeau with the emperor come clown. And that's what the states now can have. They can now catch up to Canada.
Yeah, but it's going to stop being fun for very soon.
Well, look, if he actually becomes president, I don't understand what he would do or say. He doesn't know anything.
Well, we ex-Torontonians, had an emperor as clown.
Oh, yes, that's a good point. Ford anticipates.
Mr. Rob,
hey, you know what?
Our fave. Worldwide clown.
You know, I just realized McLuhan used to say that Canada was utopia. But, you know, actually Canada lately is avant-garde. It did a rehearsal. They call it a false flag operation. Ford prepared the ground for Trump.
Exactly.
Wow.
No, really, I often make the comparisons between both of them and how popular votes actually went in their favor and why. And on the same basic kind of discourse, you know, these governments and the gravy train and all the stuff that the arguments of Rob Ford to get elected, complaining about the people in power, the usual politics as usual, so bad. He did the same shtick. In fact, I'm sure that he may have met with Trump to just share their strategy.
Okay, listen to this. Now, here's an interesting point. I'm living in Hawaii, quite removed from everything. I live in actual utopia. But here it is. One of my best friends, a friend for so long, like she's like family, her son was the aide to Rob Ford. Okay?
Oh, really?
Right. Now, my foster son...
You got surf there.
Now, listen to this. Not only did I have Sue Bone's son, who's a singer, Brendan Crosscarry, who was the aide of... when he quit after a year. He showed up on my station in late 2013 and gave all the secret stories of Rob Ford. But Ford was on the way out. He might have been sick by that point. So we got an exclusive from that guy. Now, my actual foster son is in, I think you call it in Toronto, Crown Attorney. Is that what those guys are called now?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yep.
He's the Crown Attorney that leads the investigation of the dope gangs and gangster gangs in Toronto. That's his
oh, really?
Area. Yeah, so he's the guy that makes statements in the media.
Amazing, he's still alive.
Yeah, that's a whole other and he's the guy that goes to court. So my foster son does that. Well, it turns out that Doug Ford's girlfriend or wife is my foster son nephew, niece, cousin or something. So not only do I so my foster son had to tell the police department that he had to remove himself from any visible connection to the investigation of the crack cocaine video that Rob Ford was supposed to be doing that they had.
See, you just requiring the wrong people, Bob.
I know. Wait a minute. So the point is he had to withdraw. See, because if a journalist found out that my foster son was related to Doug Ford, they would think that my foster son was, you know, causing, being compromised. So he made this statement to his staff, I have to withdraw from this. So I had two people directly, I had one guy trying to bust Rob, and I had another guy, Brendan Crosscarry, trying to protect Rob Ford. Now, this is a curious pattern in my own life. I always end up 6 degrees or 3 degrees removed from anything, and this Ford case, without any effort on my part, I didn't even know about him, that's how close I am to that. So just telling you the weird synchronicity that I experienced in this tiny little planet, which is more than a global membrane. Let me give you the stages. So 100 years ago, it was a global village. And then maybe the 50s, 60s was a global theater. Then with the computer world and moving into the Internet, it's a global membrane. And then I use Croker's ideas, and I say it becomes a mythic erogenous zone. In the 90s, a mythical, and I was using McLuhan's meaning of myth, a mythical erogenous zone. But today, since 2010, we are witnessing the millennial ecstatics of five bodies. That's what everybody's engaged in. The expression of four and plus five bodies is the fifth body, is the mystery body.
Just an aside here again on five bodies. I heard that expression first by John O'Neill,
yes.
Right? He wrote a book about it. Now, all the bodies you're talking about are the same as he?
No. I have his book, and it's sociological and not as vast as mine. Mine are whole, like basically the TV environment comes in. That's a landscape. What McLuhan called a medium, I call a landscape. The digitization of the analog TV landscape shrinks the TV landscape to a body size, to an appendage to yourself, an organ. So you add a TV body organ to yourself. And then you have the chip body, the chip organ. And then you have the chemical and astral body. He did not use such vast environments as I did. He had his...
Do you remind me of what he's wearing?
I haven't looked
meant?
At it.
I can't remember.
It's been brought up to me for 15 years. And so I bought the book and checked it out, but I can't remember because I dismissed it. I said, no, that's not what I'm talking about. So it's not bad what he's saying.
He's a pretty cool guy, though.
Yes, he was a good friend. I knew a lot about him from Frank Zingroni. He was a good friend of Frank's at York.
Yes, they were great friends. And right. I met John several times. I liked him a lot. He was quite fun, too. He had a tremendous sense of humor.
That's right.
Maybe
but,
still around.
But
I mean,
again, those guys up at York, they were McLuhan Monquet. They never acknowledged McLuhan. They had to do their own, whatever they were, leftists or whatever they were. They had to sort of redo McLuhan on their own terms and ignore McLuhan. That's what I objected to all those guys. They would not admit. Even Zingroni couldn't do it until the final days. He finally had to, he couldn't deny. I remember him being in the seminars on Monday night arguing his head off about McLuhan. And in that book, Who's Marshall McLuhan, Zingroni writes that he regrets, once McLuhan passed on, he regrets that he didn't work with McLuhan enough. So he repented, and then he went. Then he started working with Eric, and they put out The Ascension McLuhan. But that's Johnny Come Lately. There's this whole gang up at York University that stubbornly refused to recognize what we knew was relevant in the 70s from McLuhan. That's my beef against O'Neill.
Well, I met a few, and I said I met John, and John, I think I met because of McLuhan. He was very interested in my interpretation of Marshall, and he became sort of friendly with me because of that. I was invited several times to his place. He came to the McLuhan program and talked. I had good exchange. In fact, I had good beef with Rocky Raccoon. You remember Arnold Rockman?
I knew Rockman well.
I used to call him Rocky Raccoon.
Right.
Arnold was a very nice fellow. I invited him to Paris for a conference I made.
He died shortly after
and
that.
And then he died. And then there was another guy who was an expert on Bateson. Who was he? Very, very interesting man, too. That York had very good people. You're right in a way about that, but I think John O'Neill would have never wanted to take McLuhan's place. I think he had built up his own system, and he was a sociologist. Marshall was no sociologist.
That's right.
He wasn't competing. I don't think he was competing with him at all. I think that Rockman, to a certain way, might have. Maybe he's ingrown in.
They all became bitter, these guys. The world passed them by. All of a sudden, you got Wired magazine in 93, and they're bringing back McLuhan, and Rockman and everybody else was ignored, and they were pissed at that because they did not have the vision that McLuhan had. They stuck with their specialisms, their sociology, their economics, whatever their discipline was. McLuhan had the guts to not be specialized. That's why
the other guy who I'm trying to remember is the man who had the name Jones. He had a double-barreled name. What was it? Who was he?
I don't
Somebody
remember.
Somebody Jones.
I don't know that name. I don't know a Bateson.
He was a Bateson expert.
Gregory Bateson.
He was very interesting.
Gregory Bateson.
Yes.
Is this the conference that you had in Paris in 83 with Baudrillard? You talking about that one?
Yes.
Yeah, that was a good. I have the book for that. You know, the government that put out the papers and all that.
That's right.
Yeah.
It's a pretty ugly publication, but it's got
all the papers
facts.
are tremendous.
Yeah.
I mean, you got Don Steele.
I had Alexander Zinoviev, who was a very well known at the time Russian novelist who had written books which were bestsellers in France, and I had invited him to talk about Orwell versus McLuhan in 1984, because it was in 1984 we'll be doing this, and I said we were talking about Russians, and how I said to him, but Mrs. Zinoviev, how is it possible that you were allowed out of Russia? He said, oh well, you know, people who are allowed out of Russia, they always have some kind of mission. I said, oh, so you are a double agent? And he said, oh, sure, yeah. He said, I'm a double agent. And I said, so that doesn't make you feel a bit special? Not at all, he said. All Russians outside of the country are double agents.
Well, that conference technically was December 83, and then the book came out in 84.
Yeah, that's right. We were preparing for the
And was Adrienne Clarkson was the ambassador there? Is that
her name? She was not so much. No, she wasn't the ambassador. She was the head of the Canadian Cultural Center or something of the
right,
sort.
Right. So that she was there for that. Did you manage to get? Was she obligated to do that because you were Canadian, or did you have a personal connection with her to get her to do that?
No, I did have a personal connection with her. I met her. I have had many meetings with her, in fact. And one of the most amazing moments was in a plane at the time of the big vote of René Lévesque. When we had 49.5% of the per 61.
Well, that's 1976, isn't it? Isn't that the first?
1976. Yeah. But, no, it wasn't the first time I met, but it was a good time.
No, I'm saying the vote. The big vote was in 76,
yeah,
wasn't it?
The big vote was, that's right. And so at that time, just before the vote, and I was involved even at the television station where she was counting the vote. Before the vote, I was sitting next to her in the plane, and we started talking, and I said, I've just been talking with my taxi driver, who's from Togo, I believe, or maybe an island, anyway, black guy, who said, I am terribly worried about separation of Quebec. And And she said, well, aren't we all? And I said, well, I don't know. I am, and I think you are, and so was this guy. And she said, the reason we are all three interested, very worried about this is because we're immigrants. We know what Canada stands for. We think Canada is a fantastic place, and we know perfectly well what we're going to lose if this happens. So there was something about very touching about her recognizing her position as an immigrant in Canada, realize only people who have been in and out of Canada understand what wonderful country it is. And I think, yeah, she's got a point. I love Canada still. But,
Don Thiel said the same to me. You know, Don Thiel was a New Yorker, and he said the same thing. He said, I wish Canadians understood how great a country they had. That's what he used to say.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, no, Canada was an amazing... To have been able to live in Canada during that period, if I had been, I mean, I love being here. It's fun, you know. I'm watching Rome, and I think it's fantastic, and it's very nice to be around Europe. But I wouldn't want to have my career here.
No,
I wouldn't want to have my whole life here because it's narrower. It just is. Everything is just tighter, and people are more afraid. And it's like, you know, people shut their door with, you know, triple bars and so on. There's no more crime here than there is in Canada. It's a mentality of also local administration and bureaucracies are completely insane.
They're just completely insane.
You think you're in India for a while. Anyway.
Bucky Fuller said in the 70s that Toronto was the best city in the world, and it was very good in the 70s and 80s. It was a really great time to live there, which we both did.
Oh, for sure. Well, I probably still is quite nice to live there anyway. But I'm glad. I'm going back next week, and I'll be in Toronto for a week and then come back here and then back again. I'll be there still a bit of... I'm quite pleased to go back. I mean, that's fantastic.
It's a different world now for you, or maybe for everybody. Canada isn't so attractive right now. You prefer to be not in Canada. You like to go back, but you want to be in Europe now for some reason.
No, I love Europe. It's fun. It's beautiful. There's lots of things to do here, a lot more than when I was in Toronto.
Right.
In Toronto, you're kind of obliged to follow a limited pattern of social behavior, of entertainment, of news. There's a lot of really, really good things about Toronto, but the immense variety of Europe, you know, you don't have... If I go to Buffalo or if I go to... I have to go to Montreal to have a sense of difference, and I like that difference. I find it exciting, and I love going to Montreal. But here, you know, last week I was in Florence, and then I was in Bologna, and then I was in Torino, and God knows, and of course I came back to Rome, and I'm invited to, I can't remember the place, Teramo, it's called. Anyway, but I'm just saying, everywhere I go, the food is different, the architecture is different, the people are different.
Right.
And if I move from Italy to France, then I have the same thing as I had from Toronto to Montreal. I'm moving from one language to the other. And the other thing that's fun for me here is that I started my life in French. I lived most of it in English, and now I'm living it in Italian. I think it's a lot of fun to have had three languages to live in.
Okay,
you occupy a language like you occupy a house.
Right, right. And when I was there in 2014, the spirit I picked up was the young people. They don't have these big university debts. They got their university generally paid for. That's really a different environment.
They do. But that's the case. They get what they pay for.
Oh, is that right? You're not impressed with the education
system? Oh, God. You would not believe how ridiculous, you know, the educational system in Naples was. And I've, you know, taught in three different universities in Naples at different times. I taught a bit in Rome. I taught a bit in Ancona. In fact, Ancona, because I was in the Faculty of Engineering, God knows why they put me there, but anyway, I was there. They were much more serious, I think, than anywhere else. But by and large, you know, a student is not obliged to come to class. That's one thing. You miss 20% of the class in Canada. You're out of the course.
Yeah.
Here,
wow.
You don't come to class. A student is given, legally has to be given, 600 pages to read before he or she takes an exam in front of the whole class, nervously repeating by heart, if they're lucky, the piece that you've asked a question about. And you can't ask questions that doesn't concern that piece. Now, that's ridiculous.
Right.
600 pages. What can you learn in 600 pages? Especially because they read them at the very last day, and they're sure to forget it the day after the exam. It makes no sense. And then everybody's there snoring or talking or doing something or reading papers, waiting for their turn to show up. You have to do those oral exams in front of the whole class. I mean, it's much less work for the professor. We don't have to correct papers, which is one of the bane of my existence.
Yeah.
I don't have to do that anymore. I'm really happy. I think I was only paid for that. But I'm just saying, this way of dealing with the guarantee of some kind of learning on the part of the student body, it's a miracle that brilliant Italians manage to emerge from this system and emigrate to another country. Come on.
Well, are they up on technology, these students, even though they might not know the university courses? Are they prepared?
It all depends on the professor. Half a dozen prof, I think, in my department were actually getting their kids to learn how to use the media or use the media to do their things. And during the time of my tenure there, they started a media center where they were teaching people to use the internet and make videos and things like this and actually create journalism online. So progress is being made, but the actual, not only is the issue of content, which is absolutely wrong, I think the way it is, you know, curriculums are ridiculous here as well, but it's also an issue of the whole format of education. It is still one-on-one or one-to-many. It's not putting people together to actually collaborate and learn to do things together, which is what I've done in every one of my classes, of course,
right.
And it worked very well. In my last course, I think I had eight group of students working for eight different companies in Naples to help them do their, you know, their online marketing.
Right.
And two of my groups were retained by the companies, which means that it was really, like, really valuable for both the students and for the companies. So that's the kind of thing I like to do, and, you know.
Well, that's what McCool recommended. He said in City's classroom, he said, go out there. The kids start invading, looking and studying industries. And McCool said they'll be hired immediately.
Mm-hmm. Well, they were.
You actually are doing that similarly. So, okay, yeah. So I don't know what is a sign of less or more tyranny now. I don't know what's a sign of less or more democracy. So let's focus on this. You tell me what democracy is that you think would be an improvement. Well, what you tell me what it is.
Well, I'd love to be able to do that. it's even pretentious to try, but let's give it a try. So I would, first of all, it's what's the ground of social behavior? It's transparency, right? My question is, what are the ethics of transparency? How do you behave in a transparent world? And what I mean by transparency, it's not that you're, you know, undressed in public, but you are somehow undressable from private investigation. You're very undressable, and you're addressable at any time.
You're saying you're undressable.
That's right. You are undressable. Your people can undress you. You know, they can't do it in public, and as you walk in public, you still have clothes on, and you still look like an individual who has an internal kind of private environment that
he or she
manages.
Okay, now you're mixing your body.
Tricky.
You're not transparent on your chemical body, but you are on your chip body, and the chip body dominates. So you can say you don't have any privacy, but that's really only the chip body.
Okay, I agree, but the point is that chip body actually requires a behavior of the, you know, new behaviors on the part of the chemical, and I don't know about the astral, but surely the chemical body has to deal with it, and your TV body is dealing with it. All those things that you're saying are actually affected by the fact that suddenly you are, you know, traceable and classifiable, and
the order. Well, the surveillance knows more about you. I mean, I don't remember all the TV shows I watch or all the books or things I do, but
that's
the computer does, and the marketing is following that excessive consumer, not me, the little guy with the chemical body and the chemical brain that's thinking one thought at a time or something. You know what I mean?
So how do you behave in that condition, and what's democratic about that? What's democratic about that is the feeling of freedom that would survive that condition. How would you make somebody still feel free in a condition where whatever you do is could be held against you.
You know how they feel free?
For whatever reason.
There's no community controlling you in the chemical body, unless you put yourself in some kind of cult or something. But you're free in your chemical body to have no community. And to be not ethical in the old-fashioned way of responsible to the community standards. I don't think people follow any group standards anymore. They do wear their standards on their fingers and what they type. Incredible outrage in the chip body about all kinds of things that you think people are violating. But you yourself don't, as a chemical body, have a community that is controlling what you do.
Mm-hmm.
See? It's so contradictory. You can't even get to square one with any particular thought.
No, agreed. I mean, this is one of the reasons I find it very difficult, but I would say, just to start answering your question, I would go to that ground, of being transparent. And then once...
That's not the ground, Derek. The ground is the four or five bodies.
The
four or five bodies. Now, they're merged in electricity, granted, but they can be separate, separate areas of your being, and that's the ground, not some unified monad. Or some unified merge state. It's the ability to remove yourself from the merge state nowadays. The digital brought in renewed private autonomy for the chemical body, no autonomy in the chip body in terms of surveillance, but you have huge freedom of expression in the chip body.
Yeah. Oh, you could. Yeah, that's granted. That's granted. And in fact, what I'm now talking in many of my conferences is about the disappearance of traditional jobs. You better just forget about ever getting an undefinite period, limited time in Italy, certainly. Like, you know, that kind of employment is over, the industrial era. But what you can do is, because of the tools you have, whether it's your smartphone make videos, or whether it's a 3D printer that you can buy for $500, or whether it's Hadoop that allows you to get into big data and data analytics, you can make your own job. And not only that, companies are created online without spending a cent, such as Uber and Airbnb and Thumbtack and all these companies that are providing services that gives anybody who wants to take up the challenge to provide those services, like driving or giving your house, or lending your house while you're away. There's a whole kind of, it's a slippery slope from the formal to the informal job.
So
all these tools that we need to learn to use and to use the best we can are ignored by the educational system. Not so much in Europe. I mean, not so much in Canada, but in Italy, it's clear that they're ignored. And so I've created the order, the Jesuit 2.0.
Well,
did I talk to you about that before?
You've told me you're doing it, but I don't have the details of what it means.
The details of the Jesuit 2.0 is that it's just a joke. It's a metaphor. But the first Jesuits were basing the Western education, which still exists till today, and gave a backbone to all educational system, which was the studio, the Ratio Studiorum.
Yeah.
And that was based on the printing press, or it was based on the alphabet, based on the fact that the first thing was you learn to read and write. And then it was very, very large scale thinking on the part of Loyola, who was the guy who created it. He and his bunch, the Jesuits, actually created a system where you could also act on the stage. You had debates. Your body had to go to gymnastics and sports. I mean, it was a very complete vision of how do you train a young man. It was mostly men, but there were women too. The young man into the office of running a country or the business, mostly of running the country or doing this sort of thing. Now, what would the Jesuit 2.0 do? They would do the same, except it would be based on 0-1, on the digital culture. It wouldn't be based on the alphabet anymore.
Right.
You'd be teaching all kinds of things of how to handle all these talents and these powers and these threats as well. How to manage this culture. That's what I would call the Jesuit 2.0. And then, anyway, I've got to stop very soon because we're expecting guests this evening, and so I have to start preparing things, and they're coming in about 30 minutes, I would say.
Okay, so we get another 5-10 minutes?
Let's take five, but okay. Not more, because I really have to get working.
Okay,
yeah.
So Jesuit 2.0, I think the management, we require less management. What the people are afraid of, parents are afraid of allowing that their kids on the digital level are not 10 years old, 15 years old. They're equally ageless like the adults are. And so the biggest fundamentalists are the educational system. They stick to the book. That's the technological world's fundamentalism, is this dedication to this old-fashioned literate education that criticizes the religious fundamentalism of the Middle East or other places. You know, there's a bias there. One's a fundamentalist for the manuscript, while the Americans are fundamentalists for the printed book, and neither are relevant to what's happening every day to everybody in the planet, which can't be measured. You know, the last line of laws of media is an uncharted sea that can't be charted. Do you remember that sentence, unchartable sea that you can't chart? This is the closing of laws of media. I don't know if Eric wrote
That's
it.
That's right.
But you cannot – people do not the task today in your Jesuit 3.0 is to point out how you need to relax and allow about what you think you're managing. The idea of projecting yourself over a culture, that came from Gutenberg, that doesn't apply anymore. Everybody now projects themselves in a satirical way, mostly. Now, I should send you this dialogue between John Stewart and David Axelrod, who was the main campaign manager for Obama. So he got Obama in twice. So he was powerful on the White House imagery, and John Stewart was powerful as the mocker, the clown, in relation to the White House imagery. So these two very powerful, influential entities have a dialogue recently in Chicago, some institute. Axelrod quit, so now he's running some university thing. They have no clue of what they had done, and they're both despondent, and they come to the same point as we do. They can't offer any solutions for management, both of them, neither.
Mm-hmm.
So this is what we've got to recognize. Everybody is in that boat.
Yes. This is why I think nobody can actually rule us from the top except by tyrannical means, right? So
yeah,
it's
well, that's
by
not
obliging
the right word. Not tyrannical, by emotional means, by putting on people.
No, because that lasts. No, I don't trust that. That doesn't last long enough. You can't run a country on emotions. You have to run it on either.
You do, and it runs out, and the people become indifferent because you, the leader, aren't as important as Oprah Winfrey or whatever your culture offers for entertainment every day. They're the real management. That's what George Bush Sr. said to Dan Rather in 1992, and everybody mocked George Bush, but he was right. He said, "You got way more power than me," said Mr. Bush to Dan Rather. Rather, the hypocrite, said, "No, that's not true," but he does. The people in the major media are what people learn and listen from every day. I don't listen to Obama, what he's saying, whatever I don't know what he's doing. I don't pay any attention to it. And I don't pay attention to much to the news, but if I want to check out something, I go to Drudge Report, and it tells me what the Kardashians are doing or what Johnny Carson's widow story or what the Kirkhoff did. Did the Kirkhoff go
that's
today?
That's not a new phenomenon, but it's certainly
one. That's what I'm saying, that they've been present for the people. The entertainment's been running the show for 40, 50 years. And now it's got a crisis. Because now this is what's the meaning of Bush, of Trump, that people now are the entertainers. And they're going to put a clown in because we don't need to listen to Charlie Rose or Oprah or any of those icons anymore because we are more entertaining among ourselves with our own media that we create every day. There's a good punchline. Trump represents the new king, queen, creative artist, which is the average person texting away all day long.
That is a very good punchline. It's excellent. I think let's call it at that. If you want, we can maybe tomorrow evening or the day after. I'm going to still be kind of in one place tomorrow and the day after.
Okay, I got my radio show tomorrow, but I might be able to do it on Sunday. We'll see.
Well, let's try and see if we can do it on Sunday.
All right, I'll talk to you then. Thanks a lot, Derek.
Okay, bye, Bob.
Okay, bye.